Good morning, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, with today's Wall Street Journal. National security. A downed airman, a mountain hideout, and a high-risk rescue in Iran. As Iranians closed in on injured airmen, U.S. mounted a high-stakes mission into enemy territory. By Vera Bergengruen, Alexander Ward, Michael R. Gordon, and Shelby Holliday. For nearly 2 days, injured and alone, a U.S. aviator hid in a remote mountain crevice as Iranian forces and militias closed in on him with helicopters and drones. God is good, the Air Force colonel had radioed once he reached an elevated ridge, a message that was initially met with suspicion in Washington as possible Iranian trap as officials scrambled to verify he was still alive. Early Saturday, he heard the heavier roar of U.S. aircraft and a barrage of fire as U.S. commandos reached him 200 miles deep inside Iran. As they whisked him to safety, they blew up aircraft stranded on the ground rather than risk the sophisticated military equipment falling into Iranian hands, leaving behind a final explosion and a plume of smoke. The rescue mission that U.S. officials said unfolded in the craggy gorges of southwestern Iran was both the kind of operation that military commanders both plan for and dread. A downed American airman in enemy territory, hostile forces converging and early attempts faltering under fire. The aviator, who hasn't been identified, had been one of the two crew flying in an F-15E Strike Eagle with the aircraft call sign Dude 44 when it was shot down by Iranian forces on Friday. Shortly after the plane crash, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and General Dan Kane, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, briefed President Trump about the situation, according to U.S. officials. They told him the Pentagon had long planned for this scenario and could rescue the airmen. Once the Pentagon confirmed the aviator's identity, Hegseth rushed to the Oval Office to tell him and seek a final order, officials said. Trump immediately gave his approval. We have to get him, Trump said, according to White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt. The effort to recover the officer set off a sprawling high-rescue mission involving some 100 Special Operations Forces, dozens of U.S. warplanes and helicopters, and a last-minute Central Intelligence Agency deception campaign to buy more time, the officials said. When airmen go down, you can't get them in very tough countries like Vietnam, Trump told the Wall Street Journal on Sunday morning. He was able to climb up, as wounded as he was able to climb up into a crevice, the president continued, saying the airmen could hear the U.S. forces looking for him. A lot of great things happened. Troops led by the Central Command brought a devastating array of firepower to keep its enemy at bay. Four B-1 bombers, part of a larger armada, dropped nearly 102,000-pound satellite-guided bombs, according to two U.S. officials. MQ-9 Reaper drones also struck suspected fighters as they approached within kilometers of the aviator's hiding site. The search for an American airman stranded behind enemy lines jolted the U.S., making what had been an abstract air war feel visceral beyond the grainy footage of explosions released by the White House. It also provided both sides with a new narrative as the war enters its sixth week. The Iranian regime has portrayed the downing of the jet as proof that the U.S. could be bloodied and has challenged Trump's claims of American air superiority. In triumphant interviews and posts, Trump and some of his allies have been calling the successful operation an Eastern miracle, and the administration seeks to mobilize, flagging public support for the war. Open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell, Trump posted on Truth Social early Easter morning about the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic waterway that Iran has largely closed to commercial traffic since the war began. In a separate post, the president gave Iran an 8 p.m. Tuesday deadline to comply before the U.S. starts targeting bridges and electric plants. The most famous rescue operation that the U.S. had previously attempted in Iran aimed at freeing 43 U.S. embassy staff hostages nearly 46 years ago has failed dramatically after a series of mishaps punctuated by a fiery crash at a desert staging area. Worst case scenario, when the F-15E came under fire on Friday, the aircraft pulled their ejection handle, which blew the canopy, blasted the seat out of the cockpit, and deployed their parachutes. Below them, the damaged plane crashed hundreds of miles inside Iranian territory. But while a U.S. military team was able to quickly rescue the pilot, the other crew member who flew in the back seat of the fighter as a weapons system officer went missing. We didn't play up the first one because then they would have found out about the second one. So by not talking about the first one, it took them a day and a half to find out there was a second one, Trump told the Journal on Sunday about the missing airmen. The news first broke on Iranian state television. Reading from a sheet of paper, a female anchor announced that a U.S. aircrew had ejected from a plane in southwestern Iran. The Americans were believed to be in Koghilyo and Boyer Ahmad, a mountainous province of steep ridgelines. She urged all tribespeople and villagers to cooperate with the military and law enforcement. If you capture the enemy pilot or pilots alive and hand them over to the police, you will receive a precious prize, she said, with a backdrop of a military march. For the Pentagon, this was a worst-case scenario. It was the first time a piloted U.S. aircraft had been lost over enemy territory in more than 20 years, military experts said. Video footage of a captured U.S. airman in enemy hands would have handed Tehran a major propaganda tool and a source of leverage at a critical moment in the war. U.S. officials worried that the regime would use the airman's capture to seek maximalist concessions. Trump was in the Oval Office on Friday and Saturday and received constant updates from Hegseth, Levitt said. Hegseth repeatedly visited the White House to deliver in-person briefings. Soon after the airman landed, he was able to get to an elevated ridge and make contact by activating an emergency beacon to send his proof of life, according to senior officials. But as he went deeper into hiding in the mountainous terrain, communications went in and out as U.S. officials sought to keep track of his location. The complex mission quickly ran into problems, officials said. As the U.S. redirected aircraft in the region to help with the mission, some planned targets, including missile launcher sites, were left untouched. That allowed Iran to fire more weapons than usual in recent days, officials said. The first attempt to rescue the airmen had to be aborted. Two H-6 helicopters took small arms fire from the ground, wounding the crews in both aircraft and requiring them to land safely in Kuwait, officials said. When two MC-130Js, a special operations aircraft, landed in a makeshift forward operating base inside Iran, they ran into problems when their nose wheels sank into the ground and couldn't take off, officials said. There was a contingency plan. Three smaller planes carrying specialized teams later made their way to the remote staging area. Time was of the essence. Regular Iranian forces, pro-regime militia, and members of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps were on the airman's trail using helicopters and drones to find him. The U.S. deployed MQ-9 Reaper drones and other aircraft to strike the Iranian trackers, giving the airmen a greater chance of survival. The CIA also helped with the operation. After using its capabilities to pinpoint the aviator's location to a mountain crevice, which a senior administrator official described as finding a needle in a haystack, the agency shared that information with the Pentagon and the White House and continued to feed real-time information over the course of the operation. The CIA also carried out a deception operation to throw the Iranians off the airman's track. As the aviator hid from Iranian forces, the agency spread false word inside the country that the U.S. military had already located the downed airman and were preparing to move him overland for exfiltration. Other U.S. intelligence agencies also provided support in the mission, officials said. U.S. officials coordinated with Israel to share intelligence and pause attacks in the area to help the mission, a U.S. and Israeli official said. Israel also conducted strikes in the operation area in coordination with U.S. forces, striking assets that could pose a threat to the evacuation effort, the Israeli official said. Once the mission was complete, the U.S. destroyed the two stuck MC-130Js, which cost more than $100 million each, and two MH-6 Little Bird helicopters, so that their sensitive technology wouldn't be compromised after they were left behind. After hours of speculation, Trump posted the news shortly after midnight. "We got him," Trump wrote on Truth Social. The U.S. military sent dozens of aircraft armed with the most lethal weapons in the world to retrieve him. He sustained injuries, but he will be just fine. Artificial intelligence. An inside look at OpenAI and Anthropic's finances ahead of their IPOs. Silicon Valley's hottest startups have the same challenge, funding giant computing costs. By Berber Jin and Nate Ratner. OpenAI and Anthropic are racing toward potentially record-breaking IPOs by the end of the year. An inside look at the financials of both companies prior to funding rounds completed earlier this year shows their Achilles heel, the soaring costs needed to train new AI models. OpenAI expects to spend $121 billion on computing power for AI research in 2028. That means the company anticipates burning $85 billion that year, even after almost doubling sales from the prior year. Such losses would dwarf that of virtually any other public company in history. Anthropic doesn't expect to spend nearly as much, but its rosiest forecasts tell a similar story of mounting computer costs. Both companies are releasing new versions of their AI models at a faster cadence than ever before, while pouring more resources into the training runs that create them. The arms race is showing no signs of slowing. Below are charts drawn from confidential financial documents that both companies shared with investors ahead of their latest funding rounds. They offer a window into the economics of the two largest AI labs in the world. The information earlier reported some of the figures. What it costs to build a digital brain. One defining factor of each startup's balance sheets is the runaway spending tied to training new AI models. The reason: each jump in intelligence is harder to come by and costs more than the last one. OpenAI expects to spend much more money than Anthropic training new models in the coming years. The costs are set to be so mind-bogglingly high that both companies report two different measures of profitability, one that includes training costs and one that leaves them out. Strip out compute for research, and OpenAI is actually on track to turn a small pre-tax operating profit this year, as is Anthropic under its best-case scenario. Add it back in, and OpenAI doesn't expect to break even until the 2030s. Anthropic forecasts reaching that milestone sooner. An OpenAI spokesperson said the company is giving priority to growth over profits and could dial back spending on training, but expects a strong return on investment. Exploding revenue. Venture capital firms have stomached vast losses in part because OpenAI and Anthropic are among the fastest growing businesses in the history of tech. Each expects to more than double revenue this year, thanks largely to business customers' adoption of new AI tools. OpenAI was caught flat-footed after Anthropic released a new version of its coding tool, Claude, code last fall, but has since poured more resources into its Codex code assistant and prioritized sales to business customers. The revenue comparison between the two isn't technically apples to apples. Anthropic counts sales of its technology through cloud partners as revenue, while OpenAI doesn't. An Anthropic spokeswoman said this is consistent with standard accounting practices because the company is the principal in the transaction. Inference costs. OpenAI and Anthropic also spend billions of dollars a year to process queries made in their AI systems. These so-called inference costs currently eat into more than half of the revenue for each company, though that percentage is expected to go down over time, a sign that the technology is becoming cheaper to run. Only a tiny sliver of ChatGPT's users pay for the service, meaning that OpenAI doesn't generate revenue for a large chunk of its inference costs. Most of Anthropic's revenue comes from enterprises. An OpenAI spokesperson said the company chooses to support free users because it helps with broader adoption of its technology. He added that OpenAI can also make money from those users by showing them ads or converting them into subscribers, among other things. Both OpenAI and Anthropic will burn through a giant amount of cash in the coming years and are counting on their IPO investors to help buoy their businesses. To accommodate the massive amount of cash these companies will need to raise, bankers are trying to change the rules around IPO fundraising by asking major index providers to loosen their rules for entry. The Nasdaq recently said it would allow newly listed companies to join its index faster, giving them access to broader pools of capital. Oil prices rise after Trump escalates threats. The president warned he would destroy Iran's energy sites and bridges if the Strait of Hormuz wasn't reopened after confirming the F-15E crew member was rescued. The president warned he would destroy Iran's energy sites and bridges if the Strait of Hormuz wasn't reopened after confirming the F-15 crew member was rescued. U.S. Central Command said it is continuing strikes in Iran after the military completed the rescue of two airmen after their F-15E fighter jet was shot down. U.S. forces early Sunday rescued an American aviator who had been trapped in Iran for more than 36 hours. Following the extraction, President Trump issued an ultimatum in an Eastern Morning Post and said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal that Iran won't have any power plants and they won't have any bridges standing if a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz isn't reached by Tuesday evening. Trump said he would hold a press conference Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. All forces involved in the weekend rescue are safely out of Iranian airspace, according to U.S. officials. The aviator was one of two aircrew flying in an F-15E Strike Eagle when it was shot down by Iranian forces on Friday. A U.S. military team rescued the other crew member later that day. U.S. oil futures opened higher Sunday evening, and major stock markets rose early Monday in Asia. The rescue of the second aviator denied Iran a propaganda victory, according to U.S. officials who had worried Tehran might capture him and make major demands for his return. The U.S. said it had to destroy two of its own special operations aircraft on the ground during the rescue mission. Iran's military said it was rolling out new, domestically produced air defense systems to attack aircraft. Business. The U.S. plastics industry was in the doldrums, then the Iran war began. Shares of Dow, Lidl, Bezel, and other leap as war blocks competitor supply routes. By John Kilman. About 2 weeks ago, after the start of the Iran war, Dow chief executive Jim Fitterling told investors something they hadn't heard in a while about one of the company's most important products. "We're seeing prices go up everywhere," he said, referring to polyethylene, a plastic that goes into detergent bottles, food packaging, and many other goods. Filterling said Dow was going to raise the commodity's North American price by 15 cents per pound in April, after boosting it by 10 cents in March. 6 days later, the company said the April price hike would actually be 30 cents. Polyethylene had been in a post-COVID slump because of overproduction and ebbing demand, but the Iran war changed that equation almost overnight. The conflict's geopolitical ripples have brought a lucrative reversal of fortune to U.S.-based chemical makers, which in recent years have been some of America's most downtrodden companies. Their share prices have rocketed up, reflecting the advantage they gained after bombs began to fall in the Middle East and Iran blocked the Strait of Hormuz. In my career of almost 30 years of covering chemicals, I have never ever seen prices hike this steep and this quick, said Hassan Ahmed, a partner at Alabama Global Advisors. The war has affected every corner of the world's polyethylene industry. Middle Eastern producers, which account for 20% of the global supply, have cut production. Plastic makers in Asia and Europe curbed their own output when Persian Gulf crude oil, the raw material they rely upon, became inaccessible. That left U.S. chemical companies, which use cheap and abundant natural gas to make their plastic products, to boost production and raise prices at furious rates. Heavy demand is prompting Dow to run some facilities at close to full capacity. Those include its crackers, which heat ethane, a component of natural gas, to more than 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit. That causes the molecule to crack into hydrogen and ethylene, the basic building block of plastics such as polyethylene. "Everything that we've got running is going to be flat out for the rest of the year," Filterling said. Dow's share price reflected its improved circumstances. The stock had been trending steadily downward since 2022, and last year, Dow cut its dividend in half. But since the start of the year, its stock is up 77%, vastly outperforming the S&P 500. Fellow chemical maker LyondellBasell is enjoying a similar ride, with its stock up 84% so far this year after 2 years of decline. Chief Financial Officer Agustin Izquierdo recently told investors that the company's sleeping giant of a product, polypropylene, a plastic derived from propane and used in everything from food containers to car parts, is having a moment. "The material from the Middle East is trapped in the region, so this gives an opportunity for North America to actually start exploring polypropylene," he said. "It can be quite leveraging for us." Other U.S. commodity producers are sharing in the boom as their global rivals face higher costs, inaccessible raw materials, or transportation obstacles, said John McNulty, a chemical analyst at BMO Capital Markets. They include companies like Chemours and Tronix, which make titanium dioxide, a pigment used in paint and wallpaper, and Celanese, which produces acetic acid, a key ingredient in many industrial products. Companies that buy those commodities are on the flip side of the boom. Packaging manufacturers Amcor and Mangera, which are major purchasers of plastic resin, have seen sharp declines in their share price over the last month. Wells Fargo recently downgraded the company's shares, partly because of their exposure to the rising cost of plastic. Toymaker Basic Fun, which makes products ranging from Tonka trucks to Stretch Armstrong action figures, does most of its production in Asia. CEO Jay Foreman said surging plastic costs have cut into the company's margins just as tariffs did last year. "In the short run, we'll take the hit, but no doubt at some point it will affect consumers," he said. Analysts said an end to the conflict in Iran which President Trump has said could take several weeks, won't immediately erase U.S. chemical producers' edge. It could take 8 or 9 months for shipping and chemical plants in the Persian Gulf to get back to normal after peace is declared, they said. And the first customers in line for the raw materials likely will be in critical industries like fertilizer production. Steve Lewandowski of market research firm Chemical Market Analytics by OPIS, which is owned by the same parent company as the Wall Street Journal, said U.S. chemical companies also face global competition for the ethane that feeds their crackers. Foreign plastic makers are increasingly converting their plants to use ethane rather than crude oil derivatives, he said, thanks to the lower price and greater availability of natural gas. Over time, he said, more U.S.-produced ethane likely will be exported, eroding the advantage now enjoyed by American plastic makers. Maybe they'll have a year or two of nice margins, then people will start pulling the ethane again, and it will disappear, he said. The myth of the lone inventor is largely just that, a myth. Research confirms that small teams are more likely to achieve major breakthroughs, even if it doesn't make for the best stories. By Andrew Blackman. Their names are legendary. Edison invented the light bulb as we know it. Newton wrote the law of universal gravitation, inspired by a falling apple. Elementary school curricula are full of stories of lone inventors experiencing flashes of inspiration. Academic research, however, suggests that the way innovation really works is more complex and more collaborative. On average, teams outperform lone inventors, says Lee Fleming, a management professor at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. The romantic myth of the lone inventor doesn't really hold up. Fleming, an INSEAD professor of strategy, Jasjeet Singh, analyzed millions of patent filings in a 2010 study to determine whether teams or individuals were responsible for the most successful inventions. They defined an inventor's success by how often it was cited by future patents. The result was that lone inventors were less likely to achieve major breakthroughs and more likely to create particularly poor inventions. Why teams win? Teams are effective, Fleming says, because innovation often relies on a process called recombinant search, trying out different ways of combining existing ideas to create something new. Colleagues can contribute their own knowledge and ideas to the process, increasing the number of combinations. Team members also serve as a reality check, helping to weed out bad ideas. On top of that, science has advanced so far since the days of Newton that it's hard for a single inventor to have enough breadth and depth of knowledge to work alone. Innovators are now trained to understand a small piece of the world around them, says Brian Uzi, a professor of leadership at the Kellogg School of Management, Northwestern University. To look at large structures and make breakthroughs, you have to put all these separate points of view back together, and that's really what teams do. After a certain point, however, teams become unwieldy, and it becomes harder to organize the team and manage communication. Larger teams outperform small ones up to about 5 members, Uzi says, but after that you tend to get diminishing returns. Uzi also says that teams that include people with varied experiences or from diverse fields of research tend to be more innovative because they do a better job of bringing in different ideas. His analysis of 6.6 million academic papers found that mixed-gender teams produced work that was substantially more novel and had a higher impact than same-gender teams of an equivalent size. The collective brain, another form of teamwork, is much broader and less organized. When Edison had his famous light bulb moment in 1879, British scientist Joseph Swan was also on the cusp of inventing an incandescent light bulb using similar techniques. Swan had been working on the problem for decades. Much earlier, than Edison, as had other scientists, and they had already created functioning electric lamps, albeit not very effective or reliable ones. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read to you by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Edison's contribution was an innovation that made electric light much more practical and commercially viable, but it was also part of a larger process of collective scientific research. Look more closely at many major innovations throughout history, and you'll find a similar process of so-called simultaneously invention, different researchers consuming the same material and reaching similar conclusions independently. Newton and Gottfried Leibniz came up with calculus at roughly the same time. Alicia Gray and Alexander Graham Bell filed patent applications for the telephone on the same day, and what we all now call Darwinism could just as easily be named after Alfred Russel Wallace, who developed his own theory of evolution based on natural selection at around the same time. Michael Murthykrishna, professor of economic psychology at the London School of Economics, describes innovation as a collaborative effort with inventors functioning like neurons in the collective brain of society. His research shows that innovation occurs more quickly in larger populations with efficient ways of transmitting knowledge and a high tolerance for diversity. When alone is best. It isn't all bad news for those lone inventors toiling away in their garages, however. Research by Tian Hong Chan, Associate Professor of Information Systems and Operations Management at Emory University's Gozeta Business School, has uncovered specific cases in which individuals beat teams. In analyzing large-scale patent data, Chan and his co-authors of a paper on the research make a distinction between utility patents, describing how a new invention works, and design patents, how that invention is constructed. For utility patents, they found similar results to Fleming and Uzi. Lone inventors were about 17% less likely to achieve a breakthrough. For design patents, however, that gap disappeared, and individuals were no longer at a disadvantage. The reason, Chan says, is that designs tend to be harder to break down into components and easier for a single person to work on. We figured that might be a clue as to why a certain kind of technology invention favors the lone inventor, because it's just hard to separate out and give it to different people to work on, Chan says. The power of myth and of AI. If innovation is such a collaborative process, then why has the myth of the lone innovator remained so persistent? In popular culture, the hero story is an easy sell, and people like to explain the world that way, says Sebastian Fixen, a professor of innovation and design at Babson College. It's easier to think of Steve Jobs as a genius who invented the iPhone than it is to imagine countless teams of engineers collaborating with designers and managers for years, while also drawing on earlier inventions by other teams inside and outside Apple. I think American society is particularly in love with this idea of the hero story, Fixum says. It's part of the way this country explains its own success. The lone inventor myth also makes the act of invention seem more accessible. If inventions are sudden flashes of inspiration, then they can happen to anyone tinkering in a garage or sitting under an apple tree. Recent years have given lone inventors a new tool that could at least partially level the playing field, artificial intelligence. In theory, AI should let individuals enjoy some of the benefits of teams, such as access to a range of scientific knowledge and the ability to combine different ideas in new ways. Uzi's latest research suggests, however, that using AI as a collaborator in innovation has its limits. He had both humans and AI large language models complete a standard test for measuring creativity. Think of 10 nouns that differ as widely as possible. The AI and human scores were quite similar, even though the bots had access to vast amounts of data. Where AI proved more useful was in suggesting a better way of approaching the task. Instead of thinking of 10 individual words, think of 10 very different categories and then fill in the words afterward. If you want to use a bot as a creative partner, you don't want to ask the bot for the answer, Uzi says. You want to ask the bot for a way to think about getting to the right answer. Saudi Arabia's grand vision slams into financial reality and the Iran war. The Crown Prince's futuristic agenda was plagued by budget shortfalls and impractical designs. War plunged it deeper into jeopardy. By Stephen Kalin, Elliot Brown, and Summer Said. Vast development sites around Riyadh trumpet images of a shiny new future for Saudi Arabia, part of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's Grand Vision 2030 agenda to turn the petrostate into an international hub of trade, technology, and culture. Appeals for investment are sprinkled on ubiquitous construction fencing, along with English language catchphrases such as redefining livability and an extraordinary new normal. Prince Mohammed's vision extended to a pledge to invest up to $1 trillion in the U.S. during a landmark visit to the White House in November, earning him praise from President Trump. The warm embrace was a signal that the de facto Saudi leader, once shunned in the West, was fully rehabilitated on the world stage. Yet those extraordinary plans are slamming into reality. Over the past year, the world's largest oil exporter began pulling back on many of its promised projects and investments, met with budget shortfalls and unrealistic designs. And now the U.S. and Israeli war with Iran has plunged Mohammed's sweeping vision deeper into jeopardy. Iran's closure of the Strait of Hormuz has limited Saudi oil exports to about half their normal capacity. The kingdom was shut down most of its offshore fields and this week stopped operating on the world's largest petrochemical plants. Hundreds of Iranian drones and ballistic missiles launched at Saudi Arabia have hurt its image as a safe place for investors and visitors, even though most were intercepted. Major events have been canceled, including an F1 race, a capital markets forum, and a flag football event featuring Tom Brady. Virgin Atlantic discontinued daily service to Riyadh, which it launched only a year ago. On Thursday, major U.S. companies operating in Riyadh told their staff to work from home for the next few days, and some large office towers and business parks, including the King Abdullah Financial District, temporarily closed following Iranian threats against U.S. firms. The war has already cost Saudi Arabia more than $10 billion in lost revenues and expenses, people familiar with the matter say. The Saudi government didn't respond to requests for comment. Nearly every mega project unveiled as part of Vision 2030 is now under review, a process that predates the war, people familiar with the matter say. Officials are also reconsidering the size of U.S. investments pledged last year, the people said. At NEOM, the planned futuristic city that called for two 1,600-foot skyscrapers running 160 miles, officials had already been quietly ratcheting back plans, leaving a gaping 75-mile trench across the desert. NEOM recently canceled major construction contracts at $38 billion luxury mountain project, meant to be the first outdoor ski resort in the Gulf. Coming after years of work, it raises the prospect that enormous partially built structures, including a $5 billion dam that was 30% finished, will be simply abandoned. NEOM didn't respond to requests for comment. In Riyadh, construction crews in recent months parked their backhoes at a quarter-mile-wide pit where the world's largest building, a gargantuan cube that could hold 20 Empire State Buildings, was supposed to be built. The $1 trillion Saudi Foreign Wealth Fund, the Public Investment Fund, yanked back spending and hiring in numerous areas and sold much of its U.S. stock portfolio even before the war. In December, PIF pleaded with wealthy families, fund managers, and local businesses to pump more money into Saudi projects, people familiar with the matter said. Government departments were told to tighten their belts, reduce travel, and stay in cheaper hotels abroad. PIF Governor Yasir al-Rumayyan said at a conference in Miami at the end of March that the Saudi macroeconomic position remains strong, stable, and resilient, and PIF's portfolio is well-diversified and structurally resilient. We are a long-term patient investor. Even if a ceasefire is eventually reached, Saudi officials worry the eventual outcome will be an Iran that's wounded yet still dominated by a hardline regime that controls the Strait of Hormuz. That could leave Saudi Arabia under a cloud of uncertainty, potentially for years to come, repelling foreign investors it has increasingly been counting on for its transformation. It would also likely force Riyadh to spend billions of dollars to bolster defenses and bail out already limping projects, further straining a budget that's facing growing deficits. Everything's now up in the air. Chris Johnson, an American lawyer based in Riyadh, who helps foreign companies doing business there, said 4 weeks into the war. Prince Mohammed is walking a thin line. He has quietly urged Washington to keep the war going until Iran's ability to project power has been degraded, the Wall Street Journal has reported. But he also doesn't want the war to engulf more energy infrastructure. Officially, the government says it supports a peaceful resolution. The stakes are high. Saudi Arabia is the Arab world's largest economy and a source of global capital and investment. Saudi officials say they are still progressing toward a bigger and more well-rounded economy beyond oil, and that even accomplishing a portion of Vision 2030 will be a success. The country has undergone tremendous change in the past decade, as reforms have helped create a burgeoning private sector, loosened ultra-conservative social structures, and tackled rampant corruption. The country isn't afraid to cancel some projects if they don't make sense, Finance Minister Mohammed Al-Jadan said late last year. If we announce something and we need to adjust it, accelerate it, and make it a priority more than others, or defer or cancel it, we will without blinking, he said. Veteran Saudi columnist Abdul Rahman Al-Rashid said the crown prince cuts his losses when plans fall short or better options emerge. He isn't rushed or very much concerned with legacy, nor with media perception, unlike many leaders who get boxed in, said Al-Rashid, who was in the Saudi delegation during the prince's Washington trip. If 2030 becomes 2040, so what? The recent sharp rise in oil prices could help restore some lost revenues. Saudi Arabia is still exporting large volumes through a pipeline that carries oil to the Red Sea, bypassing Hormuz. In the longer term, high oil prices risk pushing consumers into habits that slash their oil use or could trigger a recession that hurts demand. The kingdom also faces the danger that Iranian-armed Houthi militants in Yemen, who halted traffic through the Red Sea during the war in Gaza, could block that route again. The Houthis attacked Israel last week, but so far haven't targeted Saudi Arabia or Red Sea shipping lanes. Desert dreams. The Crown Prince's vision hinges on using oil wealth and foreign investment to jumpstart new economic sectors, from tourism to mining to data centers, before the world transitions to renewable energy. The problem is there was never enough cash to fund all his ambitious initiatives. They included a new airline built from scratch, with about $20 billion in planes on order, investments in esports and video game companies totaling $38 billion, a new theme park city with the world's tallest roller coaster at a total cost of $32 billion, a collection of 30 Maldives-style resorts in the Red Sea with $10 billion already spent, and a $100 billion AI push. A major expansion of Riyadh's airport is supposed to accommodate up to 120 million travelers by 2030, from 37 million in 2024. Commitments toward infrastructure to host a World Expo in 2030 and the World Cup in 2034 are expected to cost $26 billion, according to the International Monetary Fund, including a new stadium resembling a toy transformer on a mountain edge and another that looks like a pile of crystals. The Crown Prince has personally involved with many projects, including Neom. Told that he liked architecture that looked like it defied gravity, Neom set up architectural models costing him millions of dollars in a tent multiple times a year so Prince Mohammed and other officials could choose their favorite designs as they strolled by, Neom employees said. The country's projects ran into the trillions of dollars, far more than a government with a $300 billion budget could afford. Wasted caviar. The rubber met the road at the line. The horizontal, mirrored skyscraper the prince conjured for Neom. In early 2025, staff said they were preparing to start vertical construction on the first chunk of the structure by year's end, having spent billions of dollars on what Neom described as the world's largest excavation in effort for a pit 1.5 miles wide and 150 feet deep. By last fall, work on the line all but halted as the PIF appeared to shelve the project, former employees said. Winds are slowly blowing sand into the 75-mile trench meant to hold a bullet train, while once bustling worker camps have turned to ghost towns, one former employee said. A similar scene unfolded in Sindala, a $4 billion ultra-luxury island resort project at Neom. An October 2024 launch party with Will Smith and Alicia Keys proved premature as rushed work left hotels riddled with construction problems and unable to open without hundreds of millions of dollars of fixes. Last spring, Neom mothballed the island, while staff at numerous fancy restaurants loaded baccarat, crystal glasses, and blue crocodile skin chairs into storage, former employees said. Restaurants discarded over 50 pounds of beluga caviar, likely worth tens of thousands of dollars, one said. The windswept golf course's grass turned brown while officials await a decision on future plans. In Riyadh, workers dug out a square pit the width of 4 football fields, meant to hold the gargantuan cube, intended to be about 70 stories tall, that would anchor a new Riyadh downtown called New Maroba, with a price tag topping $50 billion. A giant atrium was planned inside the structure, where hologram images of spaceships and floating boulders whizzed by visitors. While some surrounding developments may go ahead, the cube is stalled, with hopes for funding pushed years in the future, officials say. New Maroba said in a statement that its development was progressing in line with a phased and disciplined delivery approach, with excavation and foundation activity well advanced. Some lower-cost efforts have shown success. Domestic tourism and entertainment spending have increased, as movie theaters and amusement parks, once banned, have sprouted across the country. A Riyadh development called Diriyah buzzes with activity around a hub of restaurants set next to a historic ruin, with a Trump-branded hotel planned nearby. The Riyadh Metro, which opened 6 lines in late 2024, after years of delays and billions of dollars of cost overruns, is regularly packed at rush hour. Millions of women have joined the workforce, surpassing 2030 targets. The non-oil part of the economy has grown to more than half of gross domestic product. Bragging rights. Setbacks pose a threat to Prince Mohammed's wider goals of making Saudi Arabia and himself the leaders of a new Middle East. For decades, Saudi Arabia played an outsized role thanks to its vast oil production and its special status in Islam as home to the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. but the kingdom watched its influence ebb as neighbors, especially the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, raced ahead in attracting international investors. Prince Mohammed promised a reimagination of the kingdom's place in the world. Once a relatively obscure royal, he outmaneuvered older cousins and purged rivals to become heir apparent as the health of his father, King Salman, declined. He called his Vision 2030 plan, rolled out 10 years ago, ambitious yet achievable. He accompanied the push with reforms meant to modernize Saudi society, defanging religious police and ending a ban on female drivers. His impetuosity, however, seriously alarmed the West. He launched a war in Yemen that went badly and imprisoned dissidents. In 2018, men in his employ murdered Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi journalist who criticized the government. Although Prince Mohammed denied personal involvement, the CIA concluded that he likely ordered the killing. Western leaders and investors largely shunned the prince. They started to relent in 2022 after Russia's invasion of Ukraine sparked a global energy crunch. Trump's re-election brought a pro-Saudi leader back into the White House. Prince Mohammed also sought to mend fences with Iran after earlier calling its leader the new Hitler and accusing Tehran of trying to encircle Saudi Arabia with hostile militias. In 2023, he restored diplomatic relations with Iran after a 7-year break in a deal brokered by China. In an interview soon after, he said the transformation of Saudi Arabia required a stable region, including economic development in Iran. Foreign doubts. Foreign investment has never come close to reaching the level Prince Mohammed needed to fully enact his Vision 2030. Big U.S. companies such as Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and PwC have opened regional headquarters in Riyadh after the government threatened to cut them off their contracts otherwise. But foreign investment only reached $35.5 billion in 2025, according to official figures, up from previous years but well short of the 2030 goal of $100 billion. Saudi Arabia's debt load soared to nearly $400 billion. While still quite conservative compared with Western states, at 32% of GDP, it was well above the 12% level seen a decade ago. In October, Investment Minister Khalid Al-Fahil told a Riyadh financial conference that the private sector needed to take a larger role. "It is time for us to maybe scale back on this government or PIF spending and let the private sector come in and start investing," said the minister, who was later replaced. The call went out again as drone attacks spread. "We want to bring the whole world to come and invest in Saudi," said Al-Romanian, the PIF governor at the Miami conference. "Stay tuned," he said. "Updated plans for Saudi Arabia's future growth will be revealed soon." Economy, central banking, streetwise. Pain at the pump should mean pain in the economy, not higher rates. Investors mistakenly think the oil shock will push central banks to tighten policy. By James McIntosh. Central banks live in fear of their last mistake. As the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran leads to higher inflation, investors are betting policymakers will do what they should have done in 2021, raise rates or at least drop planned cuts. But there's a fundamental difference between the new oil shock and the post-pandemic boom. Inflation today, already visible in rising prices at the pumps, is driven by restricted supply as Iran cuts off oil and other shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. The 2021-22 inflation was driven by soaring demand as stimulus-rich consumers emerge from enforced hibernations during COVID lockdowns. Central banks know how to deal with too much demand. They should have raised rates much earlier than their eventual 2022 rises to hold back borrowing and spending. Today, they can't do anything about the hit to supply because, as the saying goes, you can't print oil. Yet traders are pricing almost 3/4 point rate rises by the European Central Bank this year. In the U.S., they expect rates to be flat rather than the 3 cuts by the Federal Reserve previously priced in. And the Bank of England is priced for 4 more rises than just before the war. To me, this makes no sense for 3 reasons. History, the hit to the economy from expensive oil, and the bigger threat posed to Europe than the U.S. Not that bad so far. First, history. In the annals of central bank mistakes, 3 loom large, 1973, 2008, and 2011. In the oil shock of 1973 to 74 caused by the Arab oil embargo, the Federal Reserve is genuinely regarded as having ignored the second round effects of oil prices and kept monetary policy too easy. But the mistake was made not when oil prices rose, but when they fell back to the deep recession, back during the deep recession caused by the oil price spike. As recession took hold, the Fed eased policy, then kept it easy even when core inflation refused to drop below 6%. It's hard for those who weren't there to believe now, but in 2008 and 2011, the ECB raised rates, focusing on soaring crude prices and ignoring already obvious trouble in the financial sector. In 2008, it had to reverse course rapidly as banks imploded, and again in 2011 as the entire euro system threatened to implode. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.